This is Morning Edition on NHPR. I'm Jackie Harris in for Rick Ganley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. New Hampshire municipalities seized the property of Granite Staters who were behind on property taxes during the pandemic, despite an emergency order by Governor Chris Sununu that suspended such seizures. That's according to an analysis from the Concord Monitor. Michaela Tofighi is the reporter who broke the story, and she joins me now. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for having me.
So first, can you explain what Sununu's emergency order during the pandemic was supposed to do for homeowners behind on property taxes?
Sure. So during the pandemic, Sununu issued a few emergency orders that intended to help people remain in their houses throughout the state of the emergency. The first was he suspended foreclosures, and he also issued an eviction moratorium. And as a part of these protections, he also suspended the tax deed process. So that meant that municipalities were no longer able to take ownership of houses due to unpaid property taxes. With that order, he also encouraged towns to forgive all interest owed on unpaid balances. But as you'll read in the story, that often was rarely the case. And in fact, many homes were seized during this time.
So how many towns went against the governor's pandemic order?
So there were 75 towns statewide that seized properties. And in total, 242 properties were taken during the state of emergency, which was from March 2020 through June of 2021.
Did town or city officials tell you why they violated the governor's order?
So I actually learned about the governor's order violations after talking to tax collectors all over the state. Berlin, New Hampshire, had taken the most properties statewide throughout the 10-year period we looked at, which was from 2013 to 2023. And when I was talking to their tax collector about how she does her job and the number of properties they take a year, she was like, well, one thing you should note is that we didn't take a single property in 2020 or 2021 because at the time the governor had placed this moratorium. I hadn't heard that from any other towns, so I started calling more people. And most towns that had violated the order didn't realize that they'd done so. They said, we took these properties in after talking to our legal counsel, or we followed advice from the New Hampshire Municipal Association, which basically had told towns that they could begin to resume the tax deed process and start taking properties again in July of 2020, which at the time, Sununu had lifted his foreclosure moratorium and said that the eviction process could resume. But the order that basically allowed those things to keep going didn't specifically mention anything about tax deeds.
How much flexibility do towns actually have in how they handle cases where residents aren't paying their property taxes?
So that's definitely been one of the most interesting things to kind of unpack in this reporting process, asking tax collectors, how do you do your job? How do you interpret this law? And it does come down basically to their interpretation of the state tax deed laws. Some tax collectors view the language really strictly. That means 3-year mark hits, taxes are unpaid. They will seize the property and then sell it at an auction within 90 days. That happened in Concord in January. But other collectors, I think, especially in small towns, vowed to not take homes from their neighbors. If the home is occupied, they'll try to work on a payment plan with the owner. They'll go door to door knocking, saying, are you aware that you're behind on your taxes? And if you don't pay, you'd be at risk of losing your house. Or they'll, you know, waive the deed. They'll say, if we take this house, it's a liability to the town. And that's a provision in state law that allows them to do so. And the town being a landlord to owners living there is one of those liabilities that's often cited.
What are the consequences for towns when residents don't pay these property taxes?
Yeah, so on the flip of this is that when one homeowner doesn't pay their taxes, it can shift the burden to other taxpayers in town. So New Hampshire local budgets are heavily dependent on property taxes. And that means that in most cases, especially in small towns, every dollar counts. So if revenue is down, you know, at the next town meeting, budgets might be up, the tax rate increase might be up, and other taxpayers may be paying the price for it.
Did I read in your reporting that New Hampshire has the highest property tax burden in the country?
Yeah, so New Hampshire has the highest property tax burden and is the most dependent on collecting property taxes. So 60% of budgets here are made up of property taxes, where in other states you may see larger revenue sources from an income tax or a sales tax kind of helping to offset that burden.
So have the governor or the attorney general responded to your reporting that towns have violated the pandemic emergency order by seizing these people's homes?
Yeah, no, they have not. So during the reporting process, we contacted Sununu's office as well as the attorney general's office. Both declined to comment. We asked questions about the impetus behind the order, how it was enforced, what would happen if there was a violation, and its intended duration. Was it supposed to be from March 2020 through June 2021, or was it following the Municipal Association's interpretation, which would have ended in July of 2020? They said that they could not provide us legal advice on those orders and that they were public documents we could interpret ourselves. So they have yet to comment on the violations or just the basis behind the order themselves.
Well, you have spoken to homeowners whose homes were seized by their local government. What did they tell you about their situations?
So in most cases, the homeowners who fall into these situations are elderly. They've paid off their mortgages. They're expecting to retire. They're often living on a fixed income. And then they've faced some major life event, like a major medical incident. So in one of the stories, you'll read about John Jones. He was a retiree living in Franklin. He suffered a major stroke and was in the hospital for months. So when I knocked on his door last July asking him, did you know that the city of Franklin has seized your house rather than pay taxes? He had no idea that this had happened.
Wow.
So there's often a lack of communication between the town and the homeowners. And then also most homeowners have said that once their house is deeded, the process can move really quickly. In Concord, with a January auction, you know, residents were given 108 days to pay their bill, which at that point is exorbitant. With interest rates compounding daily, it's most often a number that they can't even begin to think of how to chip away at. And the options they're left with are pay it in full or watch your house be sold.
So what resources are available for people who are facing a potential property seizure like that over unpaid taxes?
So I think the first step in finding resources is definitely talking to local tax collectors. Most residents who I interviewed for these stories were eligible for an elderly discount, a veterans tax exemption, things like that, or they could apply for a tax deferral, meaning, you know, they pay their bill at a later date and incur a small interest fee as a result. But they just didn't know that these resources existed. They're often under-advertised, and the application processes can be lengthy. But if people reach out to their local tax collectors, they can walk them through, okay, this is what you're able to apply for, and then you see a reduction on your future tax bills.
So how will you continue to follow this story?
So something you'll read in future stories is that the Homeowner Assistance Fund, which was a program created through the American Rescue Plan, was basically a Band-Aid solution to this larger problem. It provided federal money for people to be able to pay off outstanding tax bills, mortgage payments, utility bills, and in a lot of cases, save their homes. But it was a temporary fix. It expired in March. And with that, I think that there will be an expected uptick in the number of properties taken by tax deed in future years. So I expect to continue, you know, talk to homeowners, follow these auctions, see what local towns are doing and deciding to do at town meeting or in their select board meetings, things like that. And then obviously I'll be eager to follow any future legislative action around the issue as well.
The Concord Monitor's Michaela Tofighi, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jackie.
You can find her reporting series Seized and Sold at ConcordMonitor.com.
How best to introduce yourself to voters? It's a question any candidate seeking public office faces. And for the Democrats now running in New Hampshire's 2nd Congressional District, former Executive Counselor Colin Van Ostern and former Biden administration lawyer Maggie Goodlander, it's being answered through competing claims of rootedness in the state they're seeking to represent. NHPR's Josh Rogers reports.
When Maggie Goodlander and Colin Van Ostern took their turns behind the microphone at the Cheshire County Democrats' spaghetti dinner in Walpole recently, there wasn't time for subtlety. They only had 5 minutes to speak. The constraints forced them to make basic choices about what to emphasize and what not to.
My name is Maggie Tamposi Goodlander, and I'm running for Congress here in the 2nd District to fight like hell for the values that I learned growing up right here in New Hampshire.
Goodlander's foregrounding her mother's surname, Tamposi, was one choice. Vivian is Goodlander's given middle name, and Tamposi isn't a name the 37-year-old has previously featured professionally. The omission hasn't hindered what's been a fast climb for her in D.C. legal and political circles, but here in New Hampshire, the name Tamposi might ring bells. Goodlander's mother, Betty Tamposi, is a former state lawmaker who ran for Congress in the 2nd District in 1988 as a Republican. Her grandfather, Sam Tamposi, was a legendary Nashua developer and part owner of the Red Sox. Goodlander, too, grew up in Nashua. Since 2018, though, she's owned a home in Portsmouth in the state's 1st Congressional District. But before launching her campaign in the 2nd District last month, she began renting a house in Nashua, where she hadn't lived or voted since she was in college.
And no one does democracy better than the state of New Hampshire.
Colin Van Ostern, meanwhile, made his own choices about what personal details to stress during his remarks in Walpole.
I've had the honor of representing a lot of people in this room. I've driven the back roads of Cheshire and Sullivan, selling Stonyfield and Brown Cow yogurt. I've hosted field hearings with state officials, like trying to get the Hinsdale Bridge back on the 10-year plan, which we did, and it will finally be done this year. And I'm proud of that, by the way.
Van Ostern's emphasis on his executive council work is his way to prove his roots in state politics. Van Ostern is, unlike Goodlander, but like most adults living in New Hampshire, not a native. In fact, politics is what brought the 45-year-old to New Hampshire in the first place, starting with a press secretary job on Gene Shaheen's 2002 U.S. Senate campaign. Van Ostern met his future wife, Kristen, on that campaign. And after earning an MBA at Dartmouth Tuck School of Business, Van Ostern worked as a business manager at Stonyfield Yogurt and at SNHU. He also launched failed bids for governor and secretary of state. But to hear Van Ostern tell it in Walpole, these days he's less focused on outcomes and personal advancement than on the process of connecting with the state he chose to call home.
I believe it's about knowing the communities that you represent deeply and fighting hard to put them first, no matter the odds, no matter who is up against you, no matter how powerful the interests are on the other side.
As she watched the candidates in Walpole, Anna Tilton, a former state rep, allowed that she and most Democrats would probably be fine with either Van Ostern or Goodlander representing them in Congress. But Tilton was also quick to size them up in biographical terms, which for Goodlander includes a Supreme Court clerkship, jobs advising members of Congress, and posts in the Biden administration, where her husband, Jake Sullivan, works as national security advisor.
Jake Sullivan's wife is Betty Tamposi's daughter. That's, you know, political royalty. But she doesn't live in Nashville. I understand why she's there. I understand it all. And Colin, you know, has run a lot. But I think Colin is much more in tune in what's happening in New Hampshire.
And in this race, so far at least, there is little to choose between the two Democrats, save for their biographies. As far as issues go, both Goodlander and Van Ostern promise to prioritize defending abortion rights. Both say they'll work to lower the cost of everything from housing to groceries. They also promise to address climate change and to work to secure the border in a manner consistent with policies already backed by the Biden administration. In short, both are running as members of their party's mainstream.
I think the question is, can you distinguish yourself from your opponent?
Chris Galderi is a political scientist at St. Anselm College. He's also author of a book on political carpetbagging.
It really then comes down to things like personal characteristics, biographies, background.
And while this primary is still young, there are already signs that the candidates understand that's where a lot of the distinguishing that might motivate voters has to happen.
I'm in this race to fix Washington, not to defend it.
That was Van Ostern poking at Goodlander's D.C. tenure during the campaign's first largely genial debate on WGIR radio. And here's Goodlander poking back.
I'm not a perennial candidate. I'm not a professional politician. This is the first time I'm running, and what I can tell you is I've loved the month that I've had on the trail.
For both these candidates in this race, loving and staying in love with their time on the campaign trail could be critical. Josh Rogers, NHPR News.
You can find more of our election coverage and Josh's reporting at nhpr.org. I'm Jackie Harris, and you've been listening to the New Hampshire News Recap. Thank you for joining us. We'll be here next Friday with more top headlines. This is Morning Edition on NHPR.